Hi, this is Mary Wilson of The Supreme, and you're listening to my friend Mike Miller on the Harmony Street Show, and we just have so much fun, my baby love, me and Mike Miller. Woo!
It's Johnny Mathis, and you're listening to my good friend Mike Miller on the Harmony Street Show.
Hi, everybody, this is Connie Francis, and you're listening to my good friend Mike Miller on the Harmony Street Show.
Prezioso, ci sei tu, al di là del sogno più ambizioso, ci sei tu, al di là delle cose più belle. Tanto per me, al di là, means you are far above me, very far. Every star will light the way above me to where you are.
Benedict. Hi, this is Mike Miller, and you're here with me on the Harmony Street Show, and it's my extreme pleasure to have as my guest, singer, composer, actress, writer, humanitarian, champion, and one of the premier female vocalists of our time, the legendary Miss Connie Francis. How are you, Connie?
Hi, Mike. I don't know what to say after that. How do I do all of that?
Well, you are all of those things. And what's really funny is that one of the sweetest guys I ever met,
Jack McDermott,
is Jack. And you know, we became good friends, you know, quite a while ago. And, you know, I'm a member of the Footlighters Club.
It makes me so well with you all the time.
I said to Jack, listen, this is Connie Francis. I said, you know, is there anything that Connie doesn't like to talk about? He said to me, well, he says, don't ask her how she got started. She doesn't like that. I said, are you kidding me? I says, of all the things that Connie Francis would not want to talk about, she doesn't want to talk about how she got started. He said, yeah, don't ask her that.
I used to tell Mr. Piazza, I said, anyone calls me and they don't have the brains to Google me, you know, a little bit.
Right.
Or they don't look at the bio you send.
Right.
And they say, Mr. Francis said, call me kind, because it makes me very uncomfortable.
Right.
So call me kind. Ask kind. How did you get your start? I hang up. But you didn't do that again. I told you. Don't ask me how did you get your start, or when is your book coming out?
No,
those are the two questions. When people pick up friends at the airport, friends of mine visiting me, just after.
No.
Of course, you're not going to ask me how I got my start. But when is your book coming out? That's the question you don't ask.
No, I understand. Well, I do know that there is a Connie Francis Court in Bellevue, New Jersey. That I do know.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah.
That was beautiful. In fact, I have it in my kitchen.
Yeah.
I have Connie Francis Court right there above my bed.
I know. I think I ran out of gas one day there.
Really?
I'm teasing.
I loved Bellevue. The first time I met Bobby Darin, he was a wise guy, you know.
Right.
And he said, where are you from, Lee? I said, Bellevue. He said, don't you mean Squaresville? And I was really offended. I mean, who hasn't heard of Bellevue? People that come from Bellevue, Frankie Valli, Joey Pesci, all these people came from Bellevue.
Right. Right, I know that. Well, you know, a lot of people came out of Jersey, Joey D and Shirley Reeves came out of another section of Jersey, you know. So,
of course, because we had the advantage. That was one thing that people from Jersey did have, the advantage of being right across the river from the big city, and that's where everything happened.
Right. Well, you know, I heard that your handle of Yiddish is just as good as your handle of Italian, because you grew up in a Jewish-Italian neighborhood, so you could really dazzle everybody with some Yiddish every once in a while.
Well, it wasn't really a Jewish-Italian neighborhood. It was an Italian neighborhood.
Right.
And anybody who wasn't Italian needed a passport to get in. And then, at the age of 5, we moved to an old Jewish neighborhood.
Ah.
A passport to get in if you weren't Jewish. So I had really had the best of both worlds, and to me, the Yiddish language is the funniest language.
Oh, yeah.
It's a very, very sarcastic, sardonic language, and I love it. And I learned it, and again, probably no more Yiddish than all the bar mitzvah boys I ever dated put together.
Wow.
And your parents always got the biggest kick out of that, you know?
Well, that's fantastic. I know, see, because where I grew up, I'm Jewish, you know, and I hung out with only the Italian guys because only the Italian guys sang on the corner. And my father used to say to me, Jewish guys manage groups. They don't sing on the corner with them.
That's right.
But I got even with him because I only married Italian girls.
Did you really?
Oh, yeah. My wife's Italian. Yeah.
No kidding.
Only she thinks...
That's a very, very good combination.
Yeah, she thinks it's sauce, though. I keep telling her, all my friends used to say gravy, but she says, no, it's sauce.
It's sauce, well...
So, I don't know, you know...
Generation.
But you know what?
It's still gravy to me.
But
it's a different generation.
But it's win-win for me, because no matter what they call it, absolutely, I win. Now, when I was a kid... You know, I was a Bronx kid, and we moved up to Armonk at an early age. My parents used to drive up the Sawmill and the Taconic. My brother and I would sit in the car, And they would listen to radio stations, you know, that had, you know, the 40 stuff and whatever they had. And I was always yelling at them to change the station so I could hear the stuff that I wanted to hear. And I was wondering when you were growing up what you were listening to on the radio when your ears found the radio. What was your ear attracted to in those days?
Well, there was the hit parade. I mean, that was it.
Right.
And I would listen to and really learn from, I'm talking about hours.
Right.
Of every top female vocalist in the late 40s, early 50s. Patti Page, Joe Stafford, Kitty Callan, Joni James. There were so many great girls, Rosie Cooney, so many great K-star. I mean, I would listen to them and listen and find out what the qualities about them made them successful. What was appealing about them?
Right.
And the change from song to song. And I really learned a great deal from listening, not so much the male singers. I love the male singers.
Right.
I learned a great deal, except for Sinatra, of course. Everybody learned phrasing from Frank.
Right.
But, yeah, that's what I did. I mean, it was just the way today everybody listens to top 40. I don't listen to top 40 radio. I really can't identify with it.
Right. Now, I do an...
Absolutely no identification with the music that's being put out today. And I'm not... This is not a put-down.
Right.
But I don't know it. I'm not comfortable with it. I don't know what they're saying. Words are even more important than music.
For sure.
And that's why I think that much of my successes as a record seller was worldwide is that I recorded in 11 or 12 different languages.
Right, right.
And I realized that the first time I went to Germany, I mean, I was a big star in the United States, but in Germany, just so-so, really nothing to rave about. And my father said, spend a few days there, see what's going on there. And there was an American singer anywhere on the charts, anywhere, aside from English-speaking countries.
Wow.
Yes, there were lots of American artists, not even in England. It was all British stars.
Wow.
And South Africa, New Zealand, Australia, but not American singers. And I realized in Germany that if I was going to make hit records, I had to sing in the language of that country.
Right.
That's what I started to do. Of course, Italian was no problem because that was at the kitchen table. I learned
right.
I first heard in Italy. When they heard me speak, they said, my God, Connie, where did you learn these words? I said, my grandma taught me.
Wow.
You know what I mean?
Oh, of course.
Mama, and that became hit songs. I really didn't speak Italian. I did it phonetically. And you know, I just knew the first words.
I understand that. I can understand that.
Words to a song are very important. It's another reason why I really am not a jazz fan.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't like vocal or instrumental calisthenics.
Uh-huh.
Feel. Oh,
interesting.
And I can't feel it unless it has words.
Nur in meinem Traum.
That's very, very interesting. You know, and I just thought of something funny. I'm thinking when you left Germany, they had to wait until David Hasselhoff in order to have an American guy go over there and have hits in Germany. I'm only kidding.
No, that's true. No, and then, of course, Cliff Richards became very big in Germany.
Oh, for sure.
There are no American artists on the charts at all there, except Elvis. Elvis was stationed there at the time.
Right, right. I remember that, yeah. Well, you know, a lot of the Spaniards and, you know, we went to Barcelona and, of course, in England and in Germany now, they're all getting back around and starting little doo-wop groups and embracing the harmony groups now, and there's a lot of groups springing up.
You know, everything old is new again.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
It comes around. It's just a magical cycle. Yeah. This cycle has lasted too long for me.
Right.
I would love to hear a song I become passionate about, a little Whitney Houston type of thing.
Right.
I don't hear that anymore.
No, well, you know, because it's all
doing vocal exercises.
It's about production, and of course, you know, we have pitch correction now, and we have all of those things that.
Singers, that was funny. You know, when I heard that, you could go into the studio and just beep his note, and it could go on and on and on forever.
Right.
And I remember the first session I did with Neil Sedaka was Stupid Cupid.
Right.
When I wanted to do a double voice, I had to do it exactly the same way the second
right.
time, so it would sound like one voice. Now, of course, they push a button.
Right.
You want two solo lines, you got it. You want four, you got it. You got a group, you got it.
Right.
A place to call a naval choir with a button. But then everything was so new.
And not only that, every 15-year-old kid has it on Pro Tools in his computer, and they're making productions that 40 years ago took a whole room full of equipment, and these kids are making it in their room up, you know, up in the bedroom in the corner, and it's amazing.
Exactly right, and they're so good at it. But there was nothing moving or majestic to be 21. To be at Abbey Hall Studios in London with the London Symphony Orchestra
Wow. And
doing great, great Italian and Jewish and Spanish songs. I mean, that was just 72, 82 musicians. It was like those things are classics that will live forever.
Wow.
The tracks themselves are just absolutely amazing.
Of things I should be thankful for, I've had a goodly share. And as I sit here in the comfort of a cozy chair, my fancy takes me to a humble Eastside tenement, three flights up in the rear, to where my childhood days were spent. It wasn't much like paradise, but mid the dirt and there sat the sweetest angel, one that I fondly call. Ayer de Shemama, es gibt nicht besser in der Welt. Ayer de Shemama, oi weh, wie bitter, wenn sie fällt, wie schön. Und Feier wird sie gelaufen vor ihr Kind, nicht holden ihr Teil. frescos in.
You know,
I couldn't add my voice to it.
Listen, I remember even thinking back in my... I always say this. I was happy to be a small pebble on a beautiful beach with a lot of great singers and everything else. But I'm that small pebble who made a little noise and whatever. But the point is, I remember in those days, if the drummer dropped the stick, you started from scratch. So.
Well, no, they actually did take the reel, which
right.
is huge. And they cut it with a scissor.
And scotched it.
Together again. That was the, I mean, come on. I think about those days and I said, oh, wow. The first session I did in Nashville was an interesting story.
Go ahead.
Right after Where the Boys Are, you know, it was really a huge hit because I did it in six different languages. And before the movie came out, I was number one in 16 countries in six different languages before
right.
the picture came out.
Right.
Joe Pasternak, he was wonderful, he was a producer. And that year, he was producing, the year that Where the Boys Are came out, in 1961, he was producing the Oscars. And he wanted me to do Where the Boys Are. And he was just scratching all Hollywood. The song that does the most for a motion picture is supposed to be the basic for a song. And he was so ticked off because Where the Boys Are was not nominated.
Uh-huh.
But of course, you know, that takes a long time. It's political, but not
right.
only that. A foreign song had never made the Academy Award, and a foreign language had never made the Academy Award, and a BMI song had never made the Academy Award.
Wow.
So now, Sammy Kahn and Jimmy Van Heusen had two Oscar winners in a row, high hopes and all the way.
Right.
And this is going to be the first really hat-trick thing for composers, a pair of composers, to win three Oscars in a row. So Joe Pasternak showed me the five songs, and he said, are you going to do, what was it, second time around, right, Kamala? And I'll, is it? No. Why not? It's going to win. It's Sammy Kahn, Joe Pasternak, it was the first time in history that a composer wrote three Oscar winners. I said, I know. It's a wonderful song, and I'll probably do it, you know, someday, which I did.
Right.
I said, but I just came back from Europe, you know, Uncle Joe, and there's an instrumental by Don Costa that's being played all over the continent. Yeah, this song over here, everyone's sitting there. He said, but how can you sing a song where it has no words? I said, that's this week. And next week it'll have words.
Right.
I really wanted to do Everyone's Sending. I said, look, it's a global audience. There were 90 million people at that time. There's a lot of people.
Right.
But that was the interesting thing. So we did Never on Sunday, and it won. It was the first BMI song to win an Oscar. It was the first foreign language film to win an Oscar.
Wow.
Kiss me on a Monday, a Monday, a Monday is very, very good. Oh, you can kiss me on a Tuesday, a Tuesday, a Tuesday, in fact, I wish you would. Oh, you can kiss me on a Wednesday, a Thursday, a Friday, a Saturday is best. But never, never on a Sunday, a Sunday, a Sunday, 'cause that's my day of rest. Come any day, and you'll be my guest. Any day you say, but my day of rest. Just name the day that you like the best. Only stay away on my day of rest.
Tell me about the accordion.
Oh, see, it's another subject. My father had him pick out probably the most asexual instrument ever known to mankind. What? He was assumed of the accordion.
Right, but all little Italian girls played the accordion.
It was a rite of passage.
You know, right.
It was a rite of passage.
You know.
Little Italian girls.
It was something to hide.
My Italian father, who was living, had him play the accordion. All of my cousins played the accordion. And that was it. The accordion was it.
Wow.
Why, I have no idea. But it was funny because when I started, you know, I started playing the accordion when I was 3. I gave my first concert in Irvington, New Jersey at the Olympic Amusement Park when I was 4. And to hear that glorious sound of applause, I said, oh my God, what is this? I mean, it's just the most incredible feeling. But music, it is a very important part of everyone's life.
Absolute music.
Sex has such a tremendous mind-body connection.
In my worst days of my life, it was always and only music that saved me. The singing it, listening to it, producing it, writing it. And that's something, that's a friend that never goes away. It's always there.
You know, when you're out at any time, and you hear one of those oldies, it's like a visiting friend comes to pay a call on you.
No, I know.
Like a visitor, like somebody you haven't seen for a while. And you just identify so much with the best times of your life, of course, which is when you're young. You know, you have so much to look forward to. And you don't know all about the boogeymen and the craziness out there in the world.
Well, you know,
innocent for that period of time.
The music business is, in its entirety, is not for the weak, because you have your whole heart and your soul out there, and you're constantly being judged, and you're at the mercy of people who don't have your best interest at heart, but theirs a lot of times.
And, that, you know, look, let's face it, that's the nature of business at every time.
Right.
Unfortunately, but that's the nature of business. If I were to choose, maybe I met four or five honest people in show business.
Right.
In my entire lifetime. And I'm not so sure about that.
No, I hear you.
But all I say is that, you know, you look around, it's depressing to turn on TV. If you really want to, I am a CNN, I'm Connie News Channel. I mean, I'm a news nut.
Me too.
But
so
I
are we.
I'm very, very much up on politics.
Yep.
But if you really allow yourself to be drawn in by the really insanity that's going on all over the world, and much of it is our fault, this country's fault.
For sure.
I mean, there's no doubt about that.
For sure.
We talk about American exceptionalism.
Right.
We are, or were, an exceptional country.
Right.
Today, if there are people who really follow the news and who still believe that we're living in a democracy, they're deluded.
Right. You're right.
Because we are living in, as I watched it, a plutocracy, and now it's an oligarchy. Plutocracy is where the wealthy have all the power.
Right.
Now it's with just a handful of men
right.
who have all the power.
Right.
And the little guy, what happened to one man, one vote?
Right.
What happened to all of those things in our Constitution?
No, it's changed like everything else. Well, look how the music business has changed, as far as, I mean, there are performers that had giant hit records that tell me, why should I go into the studio now so I can put a song on YouTube and everybody will, download it?
Oh, or, I just got a call from a colleague of mine in London yesterday who told me that the new Madonna record came out. 1 million copies were printed and within, I guess, minutes, there were another million copies out there.
Wow.
So there's no such thing as control anymore.
Correct.
That is one of the really basic problems that we have, is that technology has so far overcome our own mental capacity to grasp it.
Exactly.
That we've lost control of everything, of technology. We've lost control of it. Copyright. There doesn't seem as copyright anymore.
You're correct. Well, I remember in the old days, you'd put it in an envelope and you'd send it to yourself with the postmark and you didn't open it. Remember that?
And I remember calling when we were planning the title song, Where the Boys Are, Joe Pasternak telling that a writer in Hollywood, and this is really unheard of, was writing the title song Where the Boys Are on consignment, you know. They were giving it a shot, and I'm talking about Sammy and Sammy Kahn, Jimmy Bennett, all the top rap writers on consignment. I said, but gee, Mr. Pasternak, my two friends from Brooklyn, Neil Sedaka, he's got a hit, he's on the radio right now, never always. I said, you gotta give him a chance to write the song. So he said, I said, well, how many days do they have? He said, they got 10 days, 7 days, 7 days, 10 days, and this, remember, he's a Hungarian accent, Jewish accent. And so I called Howie and Neil, I said, Howie, you had a chance to write the title song for my first movie. Yeah, what's it called? I said, Where the Boys Are. What a stupid title for a song. What do you think we are, magicians?
Uh-huh.
How can we write a title, a song with a stupid title like that?
Right.
So I said, get real. I said, I'm serious as disease, Howie. I mean, now you might not be excited about it, but Don and Kirshner will be very excited about it.
Wow.
The phone is here.
Smiling face. tenderly.
The most fantastic story I've ever heard. You know, my wife too, you know, because I was telling Jack, you know, my wife was Miss Maryland, Miss USA, you know, in those days.
And I've heard Jack say that.
Yeah, and, you know, we were having a talk the other day. Now you go to the airport and you see people, you know, it's like they dress like Slavs, whatever. In the old days, you went to the airport, everybody dressed up to the nines, and they were in suits, and the stewardesses all looked like they were glistening, and it was, you know, now.
Amazing. I think the most amazing decade. But in my experience, in a very long life, was the 60s.
Right.
Everything happened in the 60s, good and bad. We were a nation floundering. In my book, I quote Norman Mailer, who said that America died on that rainy afternoon in Dallas.
Right.
And I do believe that. I think that everything was downhill after the death of JFK. And then RFK and Martin Luther King. It was just downhill all the way from there. I don't know of one positive thing that's happened in this country since the death of JFK.
No, you're right.
We lost our way. We were in a state of shock. And we were just beginning to get out of that shock when RFK came along and gave us that hope back. And then when he died, it was just like we lost our souls. That's what the kids turned to drugs. They rebelled against their parents because they knew that they'd been sold a bill of goods about our country to their parents.
Right.
And in my book, the book I'm writing now,
right.
I think for the first time, I will be really telling the true story of the assassination of JFK.
Wow.
Aspect of it, from the CIA's point of view, from the mafia's point of view, from the American citizens and how it affected us. We have never recovered from that event.
Well, you know, what's funny too, and I was just thinking of something that goes along with that, is that if you think about it, the lyrics to the music changed, and the music changed too, and maybe not for the better.
No, it didn't.
So, you know, because the music does reflect the times.
The heart was taken right out of us. The heart, the disenfranchised, the blacks, the youth of our country, the people that count, the people who made this country. We have no middle class anymore.
No, I agree.
Middle class is disappearing. Well, I'd like to see an average middle class citizen. They can't, the middle class cannot survive in this country anymore. It's all in the hands of a few wealthy people. And that's not what our country's supposed to be about. And I cannot tell you how distressing it is for me every night as I watch the news. But I've come to the conclusion not to become apoplectic every time I hear of a new assault on terrorism.
Right.
The thing that disturbs me is that our Congress has not had one meeting on how to deal with this caliphate, which is here, right here present in our country right now.
That is correct.
I've never had one meeting on how to deal with this. Now, this is something that even Ben Laden never dreamed of.
But you know that we have so many political fat cats that have been just having a ball with the system, self-serving wise, you know, for so many years. I said, I look on TV, I say, Charlie Rangel was around when I was a young kid, and he's still there, you know, doing his thing. So I think to myself, yeah, there are no more checks and balances anymore, the ones that we were taught about when we were young.
No such thing exists. So. But you know, what I've come to really do to be able to deal with this, because I feel it so deeply, the loss of the principles on which our nation was based. It just was making me so heartsick that for the past 3 or 4 weeks, I have been lost, trying to figure out, by writing my book too, how to deal with this insanity that we as a nation, and we have created. We're exceptionally stupid. The mentality of the people who are running this country.
What?
These people are in Congress and they deny evolution, they deny...
I understand.
Where are their minds?
I understand.
They're a bubble, and facts do not reach their brains. But this is the point that I'm trying to make.
No, go ahead.
Instead of being so really, really internally agitated, fearful of this world that we have created, all of us, because those of us that don't watch the news really, really watch it and see what's going on are really to blame. We have an ignorant electorate.
Correct.
Who go out and vote for just
the wrong reasons.
They do not know what's going on. And that's why we have the people in Congress that we have.
Agreed.
After the last performance, the worst performance ever of a Congress in our history, we vote them into office again.
Right.
We reward them for their lack of intelligence. I think today, I mean, I was a Republican, I have to say it. I supported Nixon, I supported Reagan.
Right.
Nixon, I sang a campaign song.
Right.
Because what choice was there?
Right.
There was Humphrey at the time, who would have followed the directives of LBJ and in Vietnam, which was my only concern.
Right.
I knew that Nixon was not the type of person who to bring the country together, anything but. But I knew that it was in the bag for Humphrey with the Democrats, or he never would have gotten the nod for the nomination.
Right.
And who else was there? George Wallace? That lunatic from an insane asylum? Seemed to be that really vindictive, not vindictive, but there was no one else to vote for. And so I'm still apologizing for having campaigns in Nixon. And I, Polly Chapter of Nixon is the one, that was a campaign song that I sang.
Wow.
You cannot allow yourself to be overcome by these external affairs over which we no longer really have any control, and our government is doing nothing.
It happens to be the truth.
We are so unprepared. It's a joke.
No, you're right. You're
and it's going to take 11 9/11s before we wake up, I think. But the point is that all I do now is concentrate on those people in my life that I love. Those people that I can care for and have within my control to make their lives better. That's all I can do as an individual now. Because the personal person, the person, the one human being in this country today, unless he's got tons of B.A. friends and all that, and the Koch brothers behind him, doesn't stand a chance.
Right. No, I do understand that. And I think what's very interesting about the talk that we're having is this, that here I am on the other side, and I'm saying to myself, I'm going to say to Connie, how did you feel when you sang Majesty of Love, and how did you feel when you sang You My Darling, and it, gee, it charted at 93, and I'm getting the real...
You lost me. I don't know the two songs you just mentioned.
The Majesty of Love?
Yeah, it was a duet. Marvin Rainwater, a country artist?
Yes. So
yeah.
What I was saying is...
You know, I don't remember. Like the flip sides of my songs, I don't know them.
Every time you're close to me, when you touch me tenderly, I feel the majesty of love.
Mata ashita mo, ay mas.
Or in Germany, I would record maybe 8 songs and then leave the country and then remember them. How could you remember them, the titles? Forget about the titles. I don't even understand. I can't recognize the English titles.
That's funny.
Because there were like 3,000 recordings.
I ran into a guy years ago that signed us to his own private label, and he told me that he knew you at MGM. His name was Gino Moretti.
Yes, of course. Well, I remember.
Well, it's really funny. He had GMC Records, and I had a group called the Islanders. We were young guys, and we went to his house in Glen Cove, and we recorded, and we had a couple of tunes that were picked with a bullet, but fizzled out. And he would always say, "I was there with Connie Francis at MGM." I try to get in touch with him. I don't know where he is. I don't know if he's still with us. But Gino Moretti, and he always said to me, "I was there at the beginning of Connie's career at MGM." And I figured if we ever had this conversation, I would ask you about him. Yeah.
Of course I was.
Wow.
I had an appointment once when Polly Graham purchased MGM in 1971. And I went into this grand building. I mean, the edifice of Polly Graham Records was like so huge. It was like MGM times 10 studios out in California, you know. And I said, "Oh my God, you know, just from a couple of German hits, it really began with my recording."
Right.
And the man said to me, "May I have your identification, please?" You know, and I gave him my card and I needed an identification in order to get through to an office. And I remembered the MGM days.
Wow.
And there were three floors, and if I wanted to run into the PR department, "Hey, how do you like these new pictures?" Everybody knew everybody else. And when my contracts came up, two occasions, and I had offers from every studio, RCA, Columbia, Reprise, everyone, I stuck with MGM because it was home.
Wow.
I mean, Saul Hemberg, I remember everybody up there. And it was like a family. And today, it's just numbers. Numbers don't speak to me. Only words speak to me.
Yeah, well, you know, A Beautiful Afternoon was the afternoon at the Hard Rock, and of course my wife Paulette and I were there when you presented Neil Sedaka with the Lifetime Achievement Award, and that was a very, very warm and wonderful afternoon. And as a matter of fact, in the midst of the whole thing, I think it was right after Lou Valano sang the national anthem, I got a call from Lenny Welch.
Lenny Welch, oh my God, Lenny Welch, of course.
I talked to him like almost every other day, and he said, "I know that Neil is at the Hard Rock." He said, "You please tell him that I said, thank you, because he wrote a few songs for Lenny." And I
used to send Lenny. Yeah. Another promotion man with me, when I traveled in foreign countries.
Right.
I was watching a TV show called that I did. Video.
Right.
And one day Lenny and his friend traveled with me and said, "You know, Connie, when you were on stage, you're so hot. What are you talking about?" I go out of my way not to be sexy and say, "No, the way you put your hand behind your neck and the palm of your hand across your forehead." I said, "There's sound cues, dummy." I said, "Palm of your hand means I want more echo. If I pull my ear, that means I want more reverb."
Wow, that's funny, because I'm going to let him hear this interview. I talk to him all the time. He's thinking of moving to Florida. He called me and he said,
"I would love to do that."
My wife is a real estate broker. He keeps calling me and saying, "Where should I go if I move to Florida? Where should I go? Where should I go?" And Mel Carter lives not far from him.
Hi, this is Lenny Welch, and you're listening to my good friend Mike Miller
on the Harmony Street Show.
You know, I'm co-producing. You know, the kid that did Jersey Boys, John Lloyd Young, that starred in the movie. Myself and Dennis Lambert are co-producing him with some stuff. He wants to be a Michael Bublé. He wants to sing. He doesn't want to act. And we've been meeting him in Boca and getting him some material and whatever. So I do an interview with him, and he, on his new CD, he has Hold Me, Thrill Me, Kiss Me. And he goes on and on about Mel Carter. So I call Mel after the interview. He says, call him back, conference us. He says, and let me talk to him. So they talked, and he became like a 9-year-old kid. Oh, my God, Mr. Carter. I mean, you know, da-da-da-da. He says, call me Mel.
I love that song.
So I hooked up secretly. John Lloyd Young did a performance at a cabaret in California, and he won the Broadway Cabaret Award for 2014 with this performance. But we had Mel sitting in a seat in the supper club right to the right of the stage and surprised John, and it was very nice. But he's a very talented kid, but he's been doing Frankie too long, and he's gonna get lost in that if he doesn't do something else.
I'll tell you, I'm working with some things right now, and I'm sitting here watching big screen TV.
Uh-huh.
I have two big microphones on either side, speakers, and my engineer comes here, and we make records right here in my den.
Wow.
I mean, with strings and any other sound you want to get. There, you know, on this little computer, the only sound you cannot get on a computer, really, authentic, is a timpani.
I thought you were going to say an accordion.
My accordion, thank God, drowned in my basement in 67.
Uh-huh.
Father said, did you save the accordion? I said, Daddy, I drowned the accordion. I mean, I mean, that was the old recording.
Well, you know, so it had a decent sea burial. I know how close you are to Neil Sedaka. Tell me about Neil. Tell me about Neil.
Well, when he and Howie had been writing together, Howie Greenfield, they had been in Brooklyn, you know, writing they wrote about 400 songs before I even met them.
Wow.
And they came to my house, Donnie Kirsten said, there's a couple of kids, you gotta hear them. I said, really? All right. So I said, tell them to meet me at Bamberg's, and I'm having my hair done. And then you look, right? So Donnie is going around, there's a terribly hot noon day, terribly. And Howie and Neil are driving all around the block, and I'm 2 hours late for my hair appointment. They were late. Oh, I was late, probably. And finally, Neil said, Donnie, you sure you know her? You know, I just had Who's Sorry Now. It was like the number one singer in the country on American Bandstand and all that stuff. And it was amazing because in that 1 year, I thought of it at the end of 1958. At the end of 1957, or January 1st, I was typing and taking shorthand and working in my Aunt Marie's office.
Right.
And 1 year later, I was the world's most popular vocalist.
Wow.
It was in 1 year. So this is the atmosphere in which Neil and Howie first met me. Now, we were living in a really, real bad shack. I mean, it was terrible. My dad had invested, and he never invested in anything, but he invested in some Italian bleach that they sold to Italian housewives, and he lost everything, the house and Belleville, everything.
Right.
And we were living in this really crummy apartment with wooden floors that made splinters in your feet when you were dumb enough to walk on it, you know, out of shoes, you know. And exposed radiators, and Neil and Howie walked in, and Neil nudged Howie in the ribs, like, look at this place. I said, what were you expecting, Tara?
Uh-huh. You're right.
They're playing this wonderful music, wonderful, wonderful music. And I thought, and Howie disappeared, I mean, rather Donnie, he disappeared hours before.
Uh-huh.
And my mother, why are you making these kids play all these stupid songs? Why don't you just... They look like they're dying. Now, let me feed them. And my mother said, the world. And finally, I said, look, fellas, and I rolled on the couch, and I started writing in my diary. And I said, look, fellas, your music is beautiful, but it's too educated. I don't think the kids are going to dig this kind of stuff anymore.
Right.
Don't you have something like a little more lively, you know? So Howie whispers in Neil's ear, hey, Neil, play that song you gave to the Shepherd Sisters yesterday. And Neil whispers back, not that song, Howie, she's a classy singer, she'll be insulted. And Howie said, Neil, what have we got to lose? She hates everything we wrote, doesn't she? Play it already. I can play it already, whatever it is. So Neil plays Stupid Cupid. He played. I heard the first Stupid Cupid, stuck it in on the head. That's it. That's it. That's got my next record. What a smash. Hit title. Hit title. I mean, the title song has been great. The song had to be pretty awful.
Wow, wow, wow.
Title, all the songs. The title had to hit me, right? And that's how I first met Neil and Howie, but they recognized the genius in both of them.
Stupid Cupid, you're a real mean guy. I'd like to clip your whistle, you can fly. I'm in love and it's a crying shame. And I know that you're the one to blame.
Stupid Cupid,
hey, hey, set me free. Stupid Cupid, stop picking on me. I can't do my homework and I can't be straight. I need them every morning for a half past eight.
Stupid Cupid,
I'm acting like a lovesick fool. You've even got me carrying his books to school.
Stupid Cupid,
hey, hey, set me free. Stupid Cupid, stop picking on me. You mixed me up but good. Since I kissed his love and lips and wine, the thing that bothers me is that I like to find. Hey, hey, set me free. Stupid Cupid, stop picking on me. Since I kissed his love and lips and wine, the thing that bothers me is that I like it fine. Hey, hey, set me free. Stupid Cupid, stop hitting on me. Hey, hey, set me free. Stupid Cupid, stop picking on me.
Stupid Cupid. Stupid Cupid.
Unbelievable.
When I had the time to do it, and I didn't have the time, I didn't have the records anymore, because nobody did after the Beatles.
Right.
But when I would take the time to listen to all the publishers, and they would bring songs up to the office, and if I was really coming up dry, I knew to go back to the well and to go back to Neil and Howie. They were amazing. They still are amazing. Howie's music will live on forever. Unfortunately, we lost him to AIDS.
Right, right. As my brother as well, you know.
I am so sorry.
Yeah, and he had things to do. He was a VP at Burson Marsteller, you know, the big public relations advertising company. And my brother was instrumental in the PR for the We Are the World situation. Yeah, he was around when they were doing that, and he had a big hand in that. And then he got sick, you know, which was tough, you know. But he had much more to do, and you know that's another whole interview.
When I think of the Holocaust,
right,
think of the brilliance that was destroyed there, the minds.
Oh, absolutely.
The people who they could have saved the world from cancer, from AIDS, from every kind of disease. I think of the literature that we lost. I think of all the brilliance, and this holds true of everyone who were perished in the Holocaust. But let's face it. I mean, the mind of the Jewish person was really basically the foundation of what built the merchants, the business in this country. As Jews, they were thrown out of every country. They learned to be merchants. And it's really, you know, I wanted to get a lawyer. Get me a good Jewish lawyer. I had never heard of, you know, get me a good Polish lawyer.
Right.
Or something. Even a Italian lawyer.
No,
I was always asking to get me a Jewish lawyer.
It's true. That
because
I'm
education was first and foremost in the Jewish home. And Italian home, girls, my mother would say, What if she got to go to college for him?
No,
why
no.
do you pay that kind of money?
Yeah,
she
no.
could meet a guy in an office. She doesn't have to have a husband in an office. She doesn't have to go to college. That was the mentality of the Italian people in my generation for their daughters, not in the Jewish home.
Well,
it was always education, education.
For sure, for sure. You know, but my parents were good, you know. It's like... I didn't come home with a Jewish girl. I think I dated two Jewish girls in my life, and one of them was, you know, when I moved to Boca, like 15 or 20 years ago. So, you know, I waited that long, you know what I'm saying? So it's funny how that works. I want to say something about Connie, and that is, you gave so much to people with your music, and, you know, the sense that I'm getting of Connie, the real Connie Francis, is that you are so sensitive to people, and you want people to be happy, and you're an advocate for, you know, the world healing and people learning how to love each other again. You know, so you gave so much in one hand, but you're still fighting to be an advocate for happiness.
I love again.
Evening shadows make me blue. To be with you, my happiness. Every day I reminisce, dreaming of your tender kiss, always thinking how
right.
We really were home kids. We didn't have fancy apartments. I didn't have an apartment until I was 29. And my father always referred to that day as the day I ran away from home.
Right.
I mean, that's when I was 29 years old. And I had nine divorced, but I went back home and the food was better.
Right, right.
Really, we were not, I don't know what happens to these kids today. As you know, they think that once they achieve this great success, it's going to last forever.
No.
I just hope that they don't lose their souls in doing so. And I always think of Matthew. I'm not a Bible thumping advocate.
Right.
But I do believe in God. I do believe in the laws of God.
Right.
And when Matthew said, what profit is a man if he gains the whole world and he loses his soul?
Right.
And this is what we've lost today. We've lost our soul.
No, I agree, and I don't know what has to happen to bring us back across the midpoint, but we talk about that all the time. You know.
Stay out of other countries.
Right. No, you're right.
No business being in Vietnam.
No, I... For sure.
You know, that war never happened. That was fabricated. All right, go ahead. I get a little passionate.
No, that's... Which is fine, because that's Connie. In other words, what... You know, if I'm going to call you up and say, give me Connie, then you have to give me Connie the way Connie would say it. And that's why this is beautiful.
Well, we were talking about languages.
Right.
The idea of recording those initial Italian and Jewish albums was, of course, my father's idea again.
Right.
It created a bond between us that lasts to this day.
Che canta per la luna, angelo mio, sono l'ultima poetessa che si ispira a una stella, e voglio bene a te, perché sei come me, Roma. Vivere nella semplicità, nella irrealtà d'un'altra età. Tu sei romantico, amico delle nuvole che cercano lassù un po' di sole, come fai tu. Tu sei la musica che ispira l'anima, sei tu il mio angolo di paradiso. A vivere, a te racconterò, affiderò i sogni miei, perché romantico, perché
I were a member of every Jewish and Italian family in the United States of America and worldwide. And this is, follows me to this day. It's a tremendous, tremendous feeling that these recordings have been a part of people's growing up. And the bond that it created between the Jewish community and myself and the Italian community and myself will never be broken. And I would love to see that kind of music played again. I'm not saying that the kids and that particular generation of young people shouldn't have their own thing, without a doubt,
right,
whatever it is that they want to hear.
Right.
Not what's crammed down their throats, because that's what it is today. We don't even have program directors anymore. It's a joke. Give them their music, whatever they want to hear, but not to the point where all of the music is obliterated, and if you want to hear good music, you've got to download it yourself, and, you know, on your own equipment.
Right, I agree, but as much as you say
personality radio,
you became, it's interesting that you phrased it, you said that you became part of their lives. They became part of your lives, and you became part of their lives. I don't know if you really understand how much you are loved by people. I don't know if you realize or you were paying attention enough when you have a ballroom full of people that are so enamored by the fact that Connie is in the room and how much they appreciate what you've given them during your whole career. I say that because it's...
That to me is very humbling. When people tell me, oh, you're great, you're wonderful, I say, you know, I had nothing at all to do with that. God dealt me a great hand.
Right.
I could have been born with no voice, I could have been born with no feet, I could have been born a cripple, I could have been born anything.
Right.
I was born with a brain, and I was born with a beautiful voice, and I was lucky. And whatever happened to me, I mean, my gift to God, my gift to the world was to try to make the most of those talents in every area that I could. Never stop learning. And that's one thing that I live by, the words of Gandhi.
Right.
Who said, learn if you were going to live forever.
Right.
And live as if you were going to die tomorrow.
Right. No, I agree with that. And, of course, you know, we could go down the line and just mention every hit after hit after hit that you've had. And I'm going to insert a lot of them into what we're doing here. But let's put it this way. I've done about, when I started the show about 8 years ago, when I stopped singing out a lot, you know, and I've probably done about 260 interviews. And there were two that are monumental for me. Some of them are people that I've been on stage with and some of them not. One was Johnny Mathis, who I spoke to for a long period of time, who just opened up like a flower and told me things I didn't know. And, you know, the other one is tonight with you, Connie, because I've been telling Jack for a while, I need to talk to you just to find out you know, the real Connie, because, you know, we see you from afar and we know, you know, everything that you've done, and you can put on the record, many of which we have a 57 Seberg jukebox in the living room.
Oh,
God. That is an original jukebox. When I met my wife, one of the things, the first time I walked into her house, I saw the jukebox. I said, you know, because when you like the same music, boy, it's...
Yeah, you nailed it at that point. You were a goner, right? Was that the jukebox yours?
Yeah, no, the
jukebox was yours, oh, then that was it.
You at that moment, absolutely.
So in love.
You know, so...
No, are you kidding? I don't have the room for that here, but I know that every time the new jukebox was coming out, I would be on the cover of Cashbox, you know, 1961 jukebox, 1962 jukebox. And it was an interesting thing. During the early 60s, I met with guys, you know, who owned the jukeboxes. Everybody knows who owns the jukeboxes.
You bet.
These are the guys I grew up with in my neighborhood.
Right.
And they had the idea. They said, Connie, you got an idea. We'd like you to reach out to every star, the recording star, or their managers, or their labels. We want to put movies on our jukeboxes. I said, what do you mean? Like kinescopes, like, I said, tell like the story of the song.
Uh-huh.
I said, you mean like they do on the hit parade on television? Yeah. What a great idea. I said, wow, what a revolutionary idea. Who thought of that? And the mob lawyer said, they said, Leo did. I said, sure, it's always good to at the party. That's really what happened.
Right.
No, really, can you do that for us? Sure, why not? Of course, it became a three-month job to reach out to every artist or their manager. I could forget the labels.
Right.
It's so revolutionary. The labels are going to have to write new contracts for every artist. Because this is a whole new world.
Right.
It's going to be fantastic. It's going to open up. It's going to be dynamite for personal appearances. Well, what about Presley? I said, forget Presley. What do you mean, forget Presley? Why can't we get Presley? I said, because Parker will never go for it. They said, who's Parker? I said, Parker, Colonel. I said, Presley's manager. He'll never go for that.
Right.
Are you kidding? You think he's going to have Elvis had compete with his own movies in every jukebox and roadside stand in America, and we bought it. He'll never go for that.
Right.
But when you talk to him, at least, I say, yeah, I'll talk to him, and I'll tell you right now he's going to go for that. Who the hell needs Presley? I said, you do, but you can't have him. And this is the way the conversation went.
How many hours do you want? Oh, okay. I don't have to have okay.
Just hold it up on the tuck of your
tongue.
That's good, right?
I got some. I'm all shook up. Everybody's entitled to one stupid-ass mistake. You should have one in there, man. Should have one in there that you can use.
It wasn't until 9 years later that the first video came out.
Wow.
And the problem was, I remember saying to Leo, Marvin, I said, look, you guys don't understand this stuff. You are not going to be dealing with Bing Crosby and Kate Smith, dogs. You are not.
Right.
Blackheads, right? And I knew this is not going to be a good mix. And I thought maybe I would warn them, you know, this is not, you are not going to be dealing with Kate Smith. You're not going to be dealing. This is a whole new world out there.
Right.
We can deal with anybody, you know, we can deal with anybody. And I said, well, look, fellas, look, artists don't get paid a dime for playing YouTube boxes. Nobody gets paid a dime. Not the publishers, not the record companies. Nobody gets paid. So you're going to have to make this very, very attractive before I approach any artist.
Uh-huh.
And they said, well, tell you what, we'll give them as much as they would get for doing a movie. How do you like that?
Wow.
I said, that's fine. Everybody went for it.
Wow.
Except for Elvis, of course, National Department, which was very sweet and very cordial, but there was no way even in envision Elvis doing that. But the trouble is that then we had a third meeting. They couldn't deal with the black artists. I mean, I knew that in front.
Wow.
I mean, there was no doubt about that. Without, quote, clipping 98% of them, unquote.
Well.
But they said, but this is the foresight that they had in 61. Was to do movies with the jukeboxes, and it wasn't until 8 or 9 years later that the first video came out.
Yeah, I do remember.
With all of the happiness and the music going around, here's a young lady with a problem. Not too much of a problem, it's a very big hit record. Miss Connie Francis.
I'm sorry now. I'm sorry now. Aching for breaking each bone, who's sad and blue, who's crying too, just like I
What is your favorite Connie Francis song?
We never heard of it. It's on an album that went nowhere. Milk and Honey. We never heard of it.
Milk and Honey.
Yeah, that's my favorite song. But my favorite song of all time, aside from This Time Goes By, I have that too. It was all Seeing You. My friend Anita's living with me.
Uh-huh.
We've been friends 55 years.
Wow.
We met in December 1st, 1960 at the Copacabana.
Wow.
When I opened the first time, and she's now living with me because no one else will have me. I'm a serial killer. I murdered four husbands and fiancé. Seriously, I did. Not that I didn't, directly, but seriously. Four husbands are dead. One fiancé. And Anita's the only one who can bear me.
So she knows more about you than anybody else.
Anita traveled this road, this adventure that I went on, that I traveled in writing this book. And I felt at times as if I were Forrest Gump.
Huh?
Placed in the middle of every single, almost every event of the 60s that we all read about. But I, as one person wrote, that Connie was not only found herself in the midst of all of this, but one of its authors. And it really was to relive that era from my perspective, from every perspective. From the perspective of the mafia in this country and the great power that they had.
Right.
Tremendous power. From the perspective of the CIA, from the perspective of government and politicians, and I think in all of my travels over the years, and maybe I've met two or three politicians who I would say, okay, legitimate guys.
Right.
Because today, especially today, if anyone is in office, they owe somebody, a lot of somebodies, a lot of things. And their last consideration, their first consideration, is their own self-aggrandizement.
Absolutely.
They owe, too, for being in that office to begin with. They're in office, they're crooked.
I say that all the time. Right.
A lot of somebodies. Their last concern is the people who elected them to office.
Sure.
Because so the people who are electing them to office do not watch the news. They do not know what the heck is going on in this country, in this world. And it just doesn't, they don't seem to care. But that's okay. I've got the time to do that. But just think of the average American. They're just struggling to decide, many families, whether they want to put the medicine they need or the food they need on that table that week.
No, that's true.
And so where is our middle class, the middle class that built this country? I am appalled. And I voted for Obama. I am a great Obama fan.
Right.
But I'm disillusioned in many areas.
Okay.
We are totally unprepared for ISIS.
That is true.
That front line, if any of and I have said this to whoever I speak to, I haven't really done very many interviews.
Yeah, we talk about it, my wife and I as well. We're not prepared.
Now, there is a program on PBS called Frontline.
Right.
And in September, October last year, the rise of ISIS and the fall of Iraq and the rise of ISIS. If you really want to know what is going on in this world, you must see these programs.
Right.
Because then you're just spitting it air.
Mm-hmm.
You're taking guesses. When I look at anchor men and women, and they don't know what the hell is going on, and I'm saying to myself, my God, I would send telegrams to CNN, to MSNBC, to Fox, whatever. Look at front page.
Right.
Look at frontline, rather. The rise of ISIS. It began, thanks to us,
right,
for being involved in Iraq. Why are you laughing at me? Because I'm telling the truth?
No, I said...
My friend made her laughing because she thinks this is funny. It's not funny to me. And excuse me, but Amina and I laugh over everything. This is no joke. We should mind our own business. And in foreign countries, there's always civil wars. And the Eisenhower 1950, if you remember his farewell address, and he talked about the mighty military American war machine.
Right.
That monster has grown to such a point that, and I'm fearful with Republican Congress now, that all, they're so hawkish. They all they care about is war, weapons.
Right.
The Chinese were very wise. because in 1970, they realized that the new gold was not in arms, but in intelligence.
Right.
In 1970, we were number one in the world in math and science. Now we're 24th and 29th.
This is true.
About our school systems. The point is to adjust to this new world, which is very frightening, but one of our own creation. I have to say what I feel.
Well, I think it's wonderful.
Is that I'm so scared. I'm not scared anymore because it's not. There's nothing I can do as one individual anymore.
Right.
But I'm so, so fearful that see the destruction and the slow demise of our middle class and of what was once a great dream called democracy, because that's all it is. It was a dream. It doesn't exist anymore.
I think a lot of people feel the way you feel. They're just, but they also feel powerless to do anything about it, you know.
Don't go to the voting polls and don't go vote for people you don't know who you're voting for.
No, I understand. Well, you know, to vote...
Really, if Congress, the lowest rated Congress in history, you invite them back in to lead your country again?
I agree.
They'd be fired.
There should be term limits on congressmen for sure. You know.
And the dumb as they are, as a matter of fact, I think that the Republican Party is a detriment to be intelligent.
I agree. They
need it is. It's a strike against you. God forbid if you should have a scientific mind.
Well, let's put it this way. Listen to the music and listen to what that reflects. You're not getting such a great message from the music either. So Well, they're giving you back. Oh, by the way, you know, I did see you on What's My Line.
Right, yeah, yeah. I did on the show,
too. No, I know you did. They would never forgive me if I didn't ask you to say a few words about your relationship with Bobby Darin.
Do I seem as cheerful as a schoolboy playing hooky?
Do I seem to gurgle?
Gurgle?
Like a baby with a cookie?
If I do. Cause of it all is you. Think. You got something to say?
Yeah. You feel so young.
I know more than 18.
You make me feel so spring is sprung.
Every time I see you grin, I'm such a happy individual.
The moment that you speak.
What'd you say your name was again, lady?
I wanna go play hide and seek.
I'd like to go and bounce the moon just like a toy balloon. Couple of tots running across the meadow, picking up lots of forget-me-nots. Make me feel so young.
Oh, Bobby, you make me feel there are songs to be sung
and bells to be rung and a wonderful thing to be flung. And even when I'm old and gray, I'm gonna feel the way I do.
Bobby was the one true love of my life.
Right.
And as I look back now, and all the relationships I've had through all the years, one of my biggest regrets was that I didn't marry Bobby.
Right.
It probably would not have worked out because I don't think that woman would have ever been enough for Bobby.
Uh-huh.
That would have been a prerequisite for me. But I regret very much to this day that I didn't. And he will be, he'll always be in my heart and in my life. He is as a matter of fact, I just recorded a few songs with him. And I read all these fan magazine articles that were written about me. There's a fan of mine, Denise Lauren from Quebec. I was her secret sister. She told her parents that she was just so ticked off at them because they gave me up for adoption to that Italian couple in Newark. She firmly believed that I was her secret sister. Every one of those fan magazines. And they, in those days, the fan magazines were a powerful influence. Tony Curtis was a star before he ever made his first movie because of the fan magazines.
Right, right, right.
And they were like, they shared their lives with me. It was like a journey. It was like, I call that chapter Living Vicariously. They lived their lives, the teenagers of America, through mine. And they really, I did a column every week and every month in 16 magazine called Your Secret Sister.
Right.
I took it very seriously. And wrote a book called For Every Young Heart. Took it very, very seriously. Because I felt that my father said to me one day, I remember opening cartons, there were cartons all over my little house, of Connie Francis. Scrapbooks and diaries and socks, body socks and everything that you can possibly imagine. That was Colonel Parker's idea. He really, really was Elvis. Created that merchandising thing.
Right.
Anyway, this is besides the point. My father said, leave that alone. It's not important. Sit down. I said, what? He said, you have a responsibility now, don't you? You know that, don't you? I said, what? To whom? To my country, to my family? I know that. Mm-hmm. He said, no. He said, to the kids of America, especially to the teenage girls. They look up to you. They admire you. Don't disappoint them.
Wow.
And he said, the only way to do that, the only one way, he said, what? He said, lead a clean life.
Hmm.
He said, don't give the press anything to say about you, Tommy, because that's what they're looking for. It's right up their alley. Don't give them anything to say about you.
Oh. Deep in my heart.
evening shadows fall and the lovely day is through, then with longing I recall the years I spent with you. Solo per te la mia canzone vola. Mamma, sarai con me tu non sarai più sola. Quanto ti voglio. Queste parole d'amore che ti sospiro il mio cuore, forse non s'usano più. La vita non ti lascio mai più.
Cinderella world and did 180. But as I look back, everything that happened, the one thing that I thank God for was that I was never bitter.
Wow.
For all that happened, I was never bitter. I was just, even during that rape, 2.5 hours, even during the years in mental institutions where I saw horrible things that should all be closed.
Right.
I'm writing a whole thing on the third volume of my book, which will be three volumes, and the third will be on mental institutions.
Right.
It's a disaster. But of all the time, I said to myself, there's a reason for this. I went to Vietnam, and I saw the horrors, but when you see an 18-year-old kid, that was the average age of a Vietnam soldier,
right,
running into a napalm ball of fire, he beat his guts out.
Mm.
And there was a reason for that. That's why veterans in this country are probably treated worse than in any other country in the world.
Right, but you took all of that. I'm getting it. For some reason, I'm getting an echo, and I don't know why. But you took all of that, and you gave back. I mean, you're active in anti-violence, and you're a national spokesperson for mental health, and you've had laws changed, and, you know, you're not just somebody that said, oh, my God, look what happened to me. You intellectualized it, you gave it to your heart, and you have spent a lot of time in your life giving back.
And I took on a lot of very powerful people and made a lot of very powerful enemies unnecessarily, because I am very passionate, and when I see something or I hear something from me, I got to call it like it is.
Right.
And I'm really not a very tactful person. And it wasn't necessary to make all those enemies. It really wasn't. I think that you get a lot more with a feather duster than you do with a hatchet. As it was in my case, it was misdiagnosed. It was the opinion of my father,
right,
the control freak.
Uh-huh.
And one woman who, a psychiatrist, who looked at me and my house in Dallas and was very envious, a psychiatrist. Thank God I was recognized when I left the mental institutions. I met my psychiatrist. I don't have very, very much of a high opinion of them, but I do of Dr. Nucci. And she really, the answer is not in all of the drugs. There's a DVD called The Enemy Within.
Right.
The moment our troops are set foot in boot camp, they are given an amount of drugs that is shocking. When they go into battle, their heads are screwed up.
Right.
If you watch television and you watch all these mind-altering drugs and mood-altering drugs mood stabilizers and antidepressants, every one of them carries a disclaimer, causes suicidal tendencies,
right,
causes aggression. So what they're doing in the world of psychiatry is doubling down on the very problems and symptoms that our boys are. I'm not saying that there's no such thing as PTSD.
Right.
In the days of Homer, 5,000 years ago, he called it the trembler.
Uh-huh.
And then we called it shell shock, whether we called it what.
Right.
But in 1982, they decided to give it a name, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. That's what I was very suffering from those years.
Right.
And all of those things that had affected me. But to take these drugs, oh, it was a big bonanza for the big pharmaceutical companies, but it sure isn't doing our heads any good.
I do understand that. We have an awful lot to fix. One of the things that I also wanted to mention was the fact that you said that every time you hit a bump in the road, that Dick Clark was always there for you. And I wanted you to just say a few words about Dick Clark, because, you know, he was so important in our industry, you know, for such a long period of time.
My first book was, the introduction was done by Dick, and also this one. And I miss him to this very day. Without Dick Clark, there would have been no Connie Francis.
Wow.
And I can't even talk about it, tell you the truth.
Uh-huh.
It's very, very difficult for me to talk about Dick, yeah.
No, I'm
not ready for that yet.
Yeah, I do understand that. And, well, you know, he gave so many people their exposure and their start and their sea legs. And, you know, I can't think of a group that he didn't give wings to.
Dick was as kind and as wonderful to, you know, the rising stars and maybe would-be stars or whatever. As he was to the biggest stars in the world. He treated everyone the same with a kind of rare, just warmth.
Right.
And what can I say? He was my one true, genuine friend in this business.
Right. The book that you're writing now, do you have a name for the book at this point?
It's called Among My Souvenirs, The Real Story.
I see, which is quite an appropriate name.
There's nothing left. Days that used to be, they're just a memory.
though they do their best to give me consolation, I count them all apart, and as the teardrop starts, I find
Well, you know,
hundreds and hundreds.
One interesting subject is that some of them probably belong in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But then again, you know, that also has become, it started out as a good thing, but it has become very contrived and political, too. Terry Stewart, the CEO, is a friend of mine, and he said, look, I only get one vote. The nominating committee.
It's an obsession, I'll tell you why.
Yeah.
It is so fixed.
Right.
That if I were ever, God forbid, that the fact that I was number one voted male, top female singer for 7 years in a row by Cashbox and Billboard.
Right.
The number one female singer for 5 years in a row on American Bandstand every poll.
Right.
And worldwide, it doesn't mean anything to these people. So I would say that if they ever came, very, very unlikely day,
right,
never ever nominated, I'd turn it down. I have no respect for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I've said it on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame radio stations, Norman Knight, out in Cleveland. I have no respect for them.
Right.
No. And there are many people who, look, I'm not alone. Paul Anka isn't in there. And so last year, Neil Diamond wasn't in there.
Right.
Neil isn't in there.
Right.
I mean, so really, I don't think I get... my security gets too shaken up by the fact that I haven't been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall.
Yes, but you know,
I turn it down.
But the real truth is this.
The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame now.
There is
rock and, no value.
But there's a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame that is in everybody's hearts. And that's where the real Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is, you know, in people's hearts. And so that they can never take away from you, and you're there already. So it doesn't matter whether they put your name in a corner in a glass case or whatever, whatever. You know, it's done. It's a done deal already.
Early in my life, right? You
yeah.
want to give me an award, wonderful, here. Put the award over here. Put it over there with the awards over here. Awards over. I would turn that award down. There's no value.
No. You know, most people that are interviewed in situations like this, and you say to them at one point, so what's in store for Connie Francis at this point? But nobody really has to ask you that question because you are in the midst of, you know, going on with the next day in your life, you know, with purpose. You know,
it's amazing how so many of us worry about what other people think.
Right.
If we would stop to realize how little other people think of us, we would worry. It's the truth. How much time? I mean, I have people who have been in my life, and their whole center of their existence is what I am doing on that particular day.
Uh-huh.
I mean, really, I mean, please get a life of your own. I mean, it is an amazing thing to me.
Right.
But to worry about what other people think, I never have in my entire life.
Right.
I can only do what my heart tells me is right and wrong, and man, have I been wrong so many times.
Well,
especially in the romance department. It was a train wreck for me.
Well, you know, that's the human condition. I mean, you know, we only have what we have. You know, we only have so much emotion and so much intellect and so much. And, you know, you have to go forth. And you know, what happens, you know, I have this silly expression. It says, when you do what you did, you get what you got. It's like, you know, what's going to happen is going to happen. It's how you deal with it.
No, it's much deeper than that. Relationship between a girl and her father and
right.
a man and his mother
right.
influences every decision that we make in our lives.
I agree.
People that we choose to spend our lives with, whether they're friends, lovers, boyfriends, girlfriends, whatever, are in direct proportion to our self-esteem.
I agree.
And with my dad, I was never supposed to have a personal life or personal happiness.
Right.
And when you're 3 years old and you hear, you'll take accordion lessons, so this way you'll never have to take no crap from no man. And this is what you're brought up with. And I remember I was 9 years old. I wasn't allowed to do any housework. My father was not allowed that. And he said to my mother, what is she going to do, work on a truck stop when she grows up? And my mother said, with your ideas, George, she better go marry a Rockefeller. And my father said, who the hell ever said she's going to get married in the first place? So that's what I grew up with, that being a wife and mother and a homemaker was not what I was destined to do or to be.
Right.
It's a good thing because I wouldn't have been very good at it. I really feel that I belong, and I hope that this doesn't sound like a self-glorification anyway because it's not meant to be, but belong to the world.
I do understand.
Even though he doesn't know that.
Yeah. Is there anything that we haven't discussed that you might want people to know about
Connie? I wish you 1 to 1,000. Where do you want to start? Really, there is so much. And that's why I say, even to my friend Danina, stay relevant.
Right.
People tend to ignore older people. Oh, he, forget about it. What does he know? He knows, she knows a lot more in his experience, a lot more of life than you have. There's always something to learn from people.
I've always gravitated to people that were older to me, even when I was a kid. You know, when I would walk into the room when we go to family functions, I would always gravitate to the grandparents, and because I always felt that way. We tend to throw away old people because we figure they don't know.
And they have so much to say, to me, there's no limit on age. Age, to me, is timeless. Just stay relevant. I mean, be in the here and now. You can have your memories, but your past is the past.
How do you feel about things like American Idol and what they're doing with kids nowadays on TV as far as these shows are concerned?
First of all, they tie up these kids so that their whole life or career, if they do make it, they're signed up already.
Right.
They have no life of their own. It's a joke. None of these shows should be allowed to sign these kids to contracts. They should get on these shows based on their own merits and their own talents. And no contract should exist between the networks or the shows and the artists. That's number one. It is a great way to overnight success, but not if you're tied around it like in the South.
Right.
You know, the way it used to be in the South. One quarter of the entire country every day was turned to American Bandstand. Had nothing to do with payola because Dick Clark was too smart for that. He was a businessman. He went to school. Many people felt that he was too unethical to compare with today's industry. He was a paragon of virtue. He was a very smart businessman.
Right.
I valued myself. Right. I mean, I don't know what that payola meant.
Right.
I had no idea. And to know that in the beginning of the 80s, when I had friends of mine who were top promotion people, how do you make a hit record today? Well, you have to have $300,000 in cocaine for the DJ.
Oh, for sure.
That really was like a bone-chilling experience.
I watched that go down in front of me in the 70s. And I watched... I recorded at Media Sound, and I saw New York Yankees and Mets.
Media Sound, great.
I watched New York Yankees and Mets walk in and buy their cocaine from the music people, and I would say, is he really here to record an album? They say, nah, he's buying his cocaine from the music guys. I said, are you crazy?
Unbelievable. I mean, I just... the soul was just torn right out of you when you hear stuff like that.
Yes.
But and back to what you were talking about, the shows, the American Idol, the Voice, wonderful opportunities for kids that didn't exist. The only person in the country who was able to make overnight stars was Dick Clark.
Right.
But you don't tie kids up, the talented people up forever just to get a plug, to get a chat. To be on the show. It's a disgrace. Just like everything else.
It also bothers me when Harry Connick puts down a kid and this kid is going to go home because, you know, he didn't get the vote maybe.
Sure,
and maybe that's going to destroy him. And between you and I, I've seen Harry 10 times in concert. He's not the greatest vocalist in the world. So, you know, hey.
Well, listen, when you're 9 years old, as I was,
yeah.
And I said to my daddy, better than an audition. How was I, Daddy? He said, you stunk. Developed a sort of shield.
Yeah.
So that actually, through the years, if I have a bad review,
right.
I really would call the critic and say, okay, I did to improve my show.
Wow. See, now that's something.
No, really. It is something that... And another thing about that, reviews. Critics don't review the show or the performer, they review the audience.
Right.
They review the reaction of the audience.
Interesting.
They do not review the performer.
Yeah.
If you're going to let every knock, every slight, bother you even a little bit, become the secretary, become the CEO of faculty, but don't be a children. Because you got to have a really, really tough skin.
Oh, I know for sure. I know for sure.
Especially a woman. But today, women can do what is very tough in my day to do. But I say, don't make yourself so available. Evaluate yourself.
Right. Right. I agree. Connie, it has meant so much to me to spend this time with you and really get to know you better. I am so happy that you've taken out the time to talk to me, and I'm just thrilled to have done this with you. I thank you sincerely.
Well, thank you, and Jack is everything. Your reviews were great, you know. Before I even spoke to you, I knew I would enjoy this talk because Jack is a great admirer of yours. And Jack is 88 going on 28.
Wow.
I met Jack McDermott when he was a Boston disc jockey, and I was 17, and it was before we saw her now. And I was on one of my promotion tours trying to promote another mom record.
Right.
I attended Jack's record hop, and I've been friends with Beverly and Jack for all of these years, and now he runs my business very, very well. He's as sharp as anybody else out there.
Wow.
And he is one of my very, very dearest, closest friends, and my wife is the rock of my life.
Well,
Jack and Anita.
Well, I love him. I really do, and I love you, too.
You can't have them, though.
I can't have them. Connie, thank you so much.
I just wish there was some way that we could, as John JFK said in his speech in Washington the summer of the year that he died, that we all inhabit this small planet. And if we can't live all by the same ideology, at least make the world habitable for diversity.
Right.
So we each live the way we want to live without having to destroy another human being. There's something very unholy about that.
I agree.
I just hope somebody comes along and God save America, because we are in a very, very bad way in this country. I wish there was just a little bit more love between us.
And let's say it's to be continued, because, you know, I'm not just a Connie fan and always have been, but consider myself a Connie friend. And I want to ask you this question. What would you say to fans that found you all those years ago when you were young and singing and bringing people to Fort Lauderdale and acting in the movies and having all those hits and are still fans of Connie Francis right now and have followed you all of these years. What would you say to those people?
Well, it's really adorable. I lived at a place in Fort Lauderdale, Los Angeles, a few months ago. There were 13 little Chinese girls who all came to Fort Lauderdale because of where the boys are. And so many people throughout the years, I came to Fort Lauderdale because of the movie Where the Boys Are. I just wish I had a Jewish boyfriend back then with some fable who would have said, hey, Connie, buy a couple of 100,000 acres and I'll have to sing another song in your life.
Right?
With a little foresight. Because when we did Where the Boys Are, the city of Fort Lauderdale was held under control by 7 patrol cars. That was it. That was the police department of Fort Lauderdale. So I wish I had purchased some land here. But no, I think it was a wonderful era. It was, I would love to be back in those days, but we're not. We're here. And so we have to deal with what we've got.
Right.
We can't not live. And I wish it were. Yeah, it's great. But yeah. But it's not. So that's it.
I agree with you, Connie, 100%. Good night, Connie, and you have a wonderful night, and God bless you.
Mike, God bless you, too.
Back. I hear the cottonwood whispering above. Tammy, Tammy, Tammy's in love. The old hootie owl, hootie hoos to the dove. Tammy, oh Tammy, Tammy's in love. Does my darling feel what I feel when he comes near? My heart beats so joyfully, you'd think that he could hear. Wish I knew if he knew what I'm dreaming of. Tammy, Tammy, Tammy's in love.
Whippoorwill, you and I know.
Tammy, Tammy, can't let him go.
Darling, please don't hurt me. Please don't make me cry. I don't know what I'd do if you'd ever say goodbye. Remember, I love you so much, and love is life's greatest joy. Please don't break my heart like a child breaks a little toy. Sweetheart, I'm thinking of you. Don't
each other's eyes and found a lonely boat. Harmony Street. Open up your heart, recall how it used to be. Remember all the love we found on Harmony Street. Open up your heart, recall how it used to be.